supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, as baby boomers are coming of age, or of a certain age, menopause is no longer a taboo topic. Think Menopause the Musical, for instance. Women want to know what works best for them as they address hot flashes, anxiety, memory loss, lagging libido, and so on. On today's show, we're going to be talking about the, quote, change with two menopause experts. But first, we'll also discuss new research and management of symptoms. Mike and Scott visited a menopause salon where women gathered for brunch and open conversation about this topic. She spoke with the host, Amy Nislow of Haverford. Amy's children are grown, and she talked about what it's starting a new business and moving to Colorado. Let's listen.
Why did you want to have a discussion about menopause in general?
It's coming. And I feel that I hear via all kinds of information about what we should do, what we shouldn't do. And then I hear the exact opposite of what I just heard, that we should take, for example, hormones. And then I hear we shouldn't take hormones. And I just figured this would be a wonderful forum to get some real information.
And are you friends talking about it, not talking about it?
Not really, but when I brought it up, it was like a floodgate had opened, and I heard stories, and everybody's telling different stories, and so I think there was a need.
And why did you choose this kind of fun format?
I feel this is a topic that women talk about in a more relaxed environment, and I think it's easier to discuss it in a more relaxed environment instead of a formal lecture.
What worries you most about menopause, especially given that you're about to start a new business, whole new adventure?
Well, I hear sometimes people go crazy when they go into menopause, and I really am not looking forward to that. What worries me is not really a worry, just to have knowledge to deal with it the best way possible. And it's going to happen. It's what happens to us. And so I figure that I may as well learn about it.
Well, hopefully she'll learn more about it today. That was our executive producer, Mike and Scott. Well, on today's show, I've got two guests, Drs. Neil Epperson and Ann Steiner. Neil Epperson directs the Penn Center for Women's Behavioral Wellness in Philadelphia, and she's here in the studio. Welcome.
Good morning, Dan. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. Ann Steiner is a clinical associate of obstetrics and gynecology at Penn Health for Women. She joins us by phone, and she is feeling the effects of the early pollen count, and she is not in full voice. Ann, how are you this morning?
Good morning. I hope I'll make it through. I'm well enough to speak.
Well, we shall see. The future's unknown for all of us. And, of course, we'll be taking your calls. You might have a question about menopause. Give us a call. We're at 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Neil, both of you, I want you to know, you know, that I did my due diligence with this show like I do with all. I do my research, and, you know, I read through your backgrounds in both of your research, and, you know, Jennifer Lynn talks to you on the phone last week, and I read those brief interviews, and I wrote down this interview, and then I realized I didn't have to write an interview. Everybody I spoke to, who I told we were doing a show on menopause, they had a question. So I could have just listed their questions instead of all that hard work. So we'll start with my first question, and then we'll go on to probably all my friends' questions. Most women I spoke to really do have a lot of anxiety about it, about menopause. What actually is it, Neil, and what makes it so frightening?
Well, I think that's an excellent question, and I guess I'm not surprised as soon as you told your female friends that you were about to do this radio topic, that you weren't flooded with lots of questions. And I believe that it's a time of life where women know they're about to undergo a change, and it's not always a welcome change. It's shrouded a lot of times in mystery because, as the interview with Amy Nislow indicated, she hears one thing and then another. And so there's a lot of uncertainty. The one thing they do know is that eventually all women, if they live long enough, will lose their ovarian function and they'll go through menopause. And so there is concern about changes in brain function, whether they'll have depression, anxiety, mood swings, whether they'll have changes in their cognitive functioning, their libido. So there are a number of different questions about.
And all of those things can happen.
They certainly can. All of those things certainly can happen, but they don't happen to every single woman. And I think that that's an important thing to get across. A lot of women go through menopause, and I meet many women who say, you know, I never had a mood symptom. I never had a hot flash. It's not common to not have hot flashes, but there are definitely women who go through the menopause completely unscathed, as you might say.
Hmm. And now that the boomers are experiencing menopause, and we know that it's talked about more openly, what do you hear? What actually is being talked about?
Well, I think that most women will pick up on a lot of the signs and symptoms from their parent, from their mother, from their sisters, family members, and their friends. But what's interesting is the North American Menopause Society did a survey a few years ago in 98, and they interviewed over 700 women who were over the age of 50, and they asked them, what period in your life were you the most happy? And they gave them decade by decade, and over 50% of those women said after the age of 50. So I really think that, as Neil said, every woman should be treated as an individual, and that you shouldn't assume that there's going to be anxiety issues. People worry about the stresses in their family, about their job, but in middle age, there are a lot of changes that go on, and they're not all the menopause.
Yeah, that's important. And by the way, that I'm familiar with that research about people being happy in their 50s and even their 60s, and that's both genders. That these are good times for both genders. And the first symptom women complain about is hot flashes, and we know temperature regulation takes place in the hypothalamus, but why are there changes in the hypothalamus?
Well, that's a good question. I think it's the whole hypothalamic pituitary axis, really, an ovarian axis that changes during menopause and during the transition. The body perceives that there's a drop in estrogen, and the pituitary and hypothalamus are frantically trying to put out more hormones to stimulate the ovary to make more estrogen and to ovulate. And so because of this failure of making more estrogen, we have this overproduction of hormones like FSH and LH. So it's the whole feedback loop from the ovary that goes back to the hypothalamus and the pituitary.
Hmm. We're talking about menopause today with Drs. Ann Steiner and Neil Epperson. And if you want to join the conversation, if you are in menopause, about to go, or have been in menopause, give us a call. We're at 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Neil, those of us from Mars, that gender, and those women who are younger, tell us the physical, psychological experience of these hot flashes. Help me understand what it's really like, and why so many women are embarrassed about them.
Well, that's an excellent question, Dan. And I think, again, back to referable to Anne's point, that everyone experiences these things somewhat differently. But, again, there's some women who will have a hot flash and they'll laugh it off and go, oh, I'm flashing, you know, and they'll make a joke about it. Often that's a woman who is just sort of more easygoing to begin with, and maybe her hot flashes aren't as severe. They might not be happening as frequently. But a lot of the women that come to see me are frustrated by their hot flashes because they've gotten to the point that they're happening 10, 15 times a day.
Wow.
They can have a surge of anxiety associated with the hot flash sometimes.
Physiologic.
Yes, absolutely. They'll notice that they're starting to get anxious, and then the hot flash, they'll notice that they're hot, or it could go the other way around. Women who find the hot flashes really problematic are the ones that often are really, they say they're sweating bullets, and that you could see they've turned red. They may be in a meeting. They may be in a profession where they're on stage frequently, or they're running large meetings. And they live in fear of having a full-blown hot flash in that setting. For other women, the vasomotor symptoms also interrupt their sleep at night. And they wake up and they're throwing the sheets off. They're turning down the air conditioner, or turning up the air conditioner, I guess, and opening the windows in the winter. And they find that very distressing because it interrupts their sleep. So they're also sleep deprived. So again, it ranges with how much frustration a person might experience.
Does it affect cognition? So if someone is in a meeting or running a meeting, is she less clear-minded during a hot flash, or is she just distracted, which is...
I think it's the latter mostly.
Yeah,
I mean, there's
no
clear evidence that hot flashes affect a person's cognitive functioning. I mean, certainly if you're anxious and distracted, you may lose your points. You know, you may find that, you know, you're focusing more on that than the topic that you need to be discussing. But by and large, that's not what women really talk about when they come into the office. They're mostly frustrated with how much it affects what they're doing as far as people noticing that they're having these hot flashes.
And I would guess that the anxiety that's associated with might be more autonomic, that increased heart rate that gets mm-hmm. associated with anxiety.
That's a good point, and I think that you're probably right. Again, no one really knows the exact pathophysiology or the exact reason why people have hot flashes. We know that neurochemicals such as norepinephrine, serotonin are involved. And as a matter of fact, some of the non-hormonal treatments for hot flashes affect those neurotransmitter systems. But yes, I mean, certainly an increase in heart rate for some people might trigger anxiety. Again, they're not thinking, oh, my heart rate is increasing, I'm going to get anxious. That's just something that happens automatically for some individuals.
I'm really curious. You said everybody experiences hot flashes differently.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder about if they experience them similarly across races and cultures. Any research on that that you're aware of?
Well, as far as how they experience them and the impact on their quality of life, I mean, I can't say I've seen studies that have focused on whether, for example, Latina or African American or Caucasian women experience them more or less severely. I can say that, and Anne, correct me if I'm wrong, that in Asian cultures, that there's not even really a word for hot flash. They don't have hot flashes to the same degree that Caucasians do. So in any case, as far as prevalence, I mean, certainly they happen across cultures, but with some differences based upon racial groups or ethnic groups. As far as actually whether some people get more anxious or not, I don't know, Dan. I haven't actually looked at that.
And I wonder if there's a difference in the way women react to hot flashes across cultures, races.
I think it's really hard to perceive, to really define how someone perceives a hot flash, but if you look at women ethnically or racially and whether they're bothered by hot flashes, then if you were to survey them, African-American women, Hispanic women probably say that they're most disturbed by them. Caucasian women are sort of in the middle, and Asian women less. Now, who knows if that's dietary, lifestyle, has to do with weight? I mean, I don't really know the answer to that, but in terms of who says they are the most annoying and interfere with their life, there does seem to be a racial difference.
You know, our phone lines are lit up, no surprise, but I do have to tell our callers that we can't get to you until we cover this big issue of hormone replacement therapy, because that's the issue here. So, Anne, before we get to that per se, tell us about natural treatments for hot flashes like black cohosh and ginseng and things like that.
Well, I always try to talk to women first about non-hormonal treatments. There are certainly black cohosh. If you look at all the studies, there really hasn't been shown to be totally effective, but many women will say that it helps. I think that it's safe to take black cohosh for up to 6 months. There is some question about liver damage or toxicity after that, so I caution people. Sometimes I monitor their liver function, but all in all, it seems to be pretty harmless. Any study that you do looking at any possible treatment for hot flashes in which you use a placebo or a sugar pill, 30% of the time the placebo or sugar pill is going to work in reducing the severity of hot flashes. So you have to keep this in mind when you're talking about natural hormones or natural type medications, that there is some placebo effect involved with them. If I were recommending a natural product, I would say you can try the black cohosh, see if it helps. Everybody tells me there's one thing that really works well for them, but I don't think there's any great studies about any of these over-the-counter natural products in terms of their efficacy or their safety that I would really recommend them.
Well, I do want to not minimize the value of placebo effect. And I read an interesting article, I think Mike and Scott and I did it on Morning Edition this past year, about how people were given a pill, I think for hypertension, and told that it was a placebo, and many people get benefit from it, and they got benefit.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, so, I mean, placebo effect does create physiologic changes.
And, you know, the bottom line is, are people functioning better? Are they sleeping better? Are they happier?
Right. 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 Neil, before our break, when we spoke with you earlier, you said you were against practitioners who try to measure every hormone in someone's saliva and come up with something that's perfect for them.
Right.
Sounds good to me.
Well, that's assuming you know what's going to be perfect for them. I mean, ideally, I mean, these people say, well, let's measure and see what you're low on. You know, it's hard for me to say, okay, this is the perfect level of cortisol for you. This is the perfect level of DHEA for you. This is the perfect level of estrogen for you. Basically, the proof is in the pudding. I mean, if you replace that hormone and you see a benefit and the symptoms that you're targeting respond, then, you know, then that would suggest that that might be a good level for that particular individual. So for me to measure, and quite frankly, a lot of these hormonal measures can be very, very expensive, and many people are paying out of pocket for these evaluations. And I just think it's important for people to understand that really it's hard to say based upon just what's in your saliva or in your bloodstream, for that fact, when it comes to hormones, what the exact perfect dose is for you. And it really is a matter of working with your clinician over time to find something that is the right balance for you.
Mm. We've got to take a very short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about hormone replacement therapy, and we will take your calls, I promise. We're talking about menopause today, and my guests are Neil Epperson, who's a psychiatrist. She directs the Penn Center for Women's Behavioral Wellness. I've got Ann Steiner here on the phone. She's a clinical associate professor of OBGYN at the Penn Center for Women. By the way, your voice sounds just fine, Anne. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY. IBC is proud to launch the new Independence Blue Cross Foundation, whose mission is to transform healthcare in the communities they serve. The Foundation's innovation grants support projects and research that significantly advance healthcare delivery in our region. Through community partnerships, the Foundation will support new and creative solutions to reduce healthcare spending, improve quality, and expand access to care. To learn more, visit ibxfoundation.org.
Next time on Tell Me More, we take you behind closed doors to talk about a health crisis in the Navajo Nation.
We don't think it's here and it'll never get here, he says. If you're talking about it, you're wishing it on the people.
We'll find out how members of one of the country's largest tribes are trying to face up to HIV and AIDS. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about menopause with psychiatrist Neil Epperson and OBGYN Ann Steiner. And I want to get right to hormone replacement therapy. The original research about increased risk for cancer came out about 10 years ago. We've learned a lot since then, yes?
Yes, we have. And we've revised some of those findings in the Women's Health Initiative.
And?
And what they did was to go back and look at more closely at the age groups of the women rather than lumping them all together as positive or negative on the results of the Women's Health Initiative. Women over the age of 50 up to 79 were enrolled in this study. The average age was 63 years old. But it turns out that the group of women who are between the age of 50 and 60 and are newly menopausal probably are a different subset and need to be looked at more closely. And it looks like when we look at them that when we start giving one of the two types of hormone therapy, either estrogen therapy alone or, in the case of a woman who still has a uterus, estrogen and progestin therapy, that there's a different set of risks. So, for instance, there's probably less risk of heart disease, less risk of blood clot, less risk of stroke. And it turns out that probably there isn't an increased risk of breast cancer until after 3 to 5 years, about 5 years, in the group taking estrogen, progesterone, and probably at least 7 years in the group that's taking estrogen alone. Mm-hmm.
So when they when they begin taking these therapies, they take it for the rest of their lives?
No, my recommendation is to continually reassess the need and the dose of hormone therapy. The recommendation, which I agree with from the North American Menopause Society, is to give the lowest dose for the shortest period of time necessary to relieve the symptoms for which it's prescribed. So when I visit with women on a yearly basis, I ask them why they're taking their hormone therapy, and if they have a need, then we reassess continuing it. If they're doing okay and they've been on it a while, I try to taper it down or see about quitting to see if they're doing all right without it. And many of them do just fine when it's stopped. But I think quality of life is the bottom line here, and that we must continually reassess the risks and benefits of any drug we give, but especially hormone therapy.
All right. To our callers, I've got one last question of Ann, and then we'll get to you. Ann, I've got to tell you, in my research, I might be naive, but the most shocking thing I found out is not every gynecologist is specifically trained as an expert in menopause, that there's something called certified menopause practitioners. But when I looked that up and I looked for certified menopause practitioners just around the radio station, I found two physicians that are certified menopause practitioners. How do we find a gynecologist who knows about menopause?
Well, the North American Menopause Society, which I've mentioned already here and of which I'm a member, has a website, and the website is menopause.org. It's a wonderful website for consumers, and if you go to that website, I think you'll be able to find a directory with a list of menopause practitioners.
Good, good. All right. Let's go to the phones. We've got Laverne on the line. Hi, Laverne. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. My question was about chemically induced menopause. So menopause that's brought on from the onset of chemotherapy, and then the long-term effects of menopause on someone when they go into menopause at 30. Mm-hmm.
Neil?
What aspect are you most concerned about, or is this would be with just in general?
One about the intensity of the symptoms, and then also I guess long-term bone care or issues related to menopause. But now instead of starting at 50, you're starting at 30.
Ann, do you want to answer that one?
Sure. I think the first thing is, what was the chemotherapy given for? Was it a hormone-dependent disease like breast cancer or for something else? Because if it was a hormonal disease, possibly hormonally-dependent disease like breast cancer, we really would avoid giving any kind of hormone therapy like estrogen to that woman and look for alternate treatment for her symptoms. If she was being treated, for instance, for Hodgkin's disease or another non-hormone-dependent cancer, then I think we could easily talk about giving her some kind of hormone therapy. And this potentially could reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease, but to tell you the truth, we really don't have substantial evidence. So I have a number of women in my practice who, for instance, have had lymphoma and Hodgkin's disease who take the birth control pill, a low-dose birth control pill, until they reach the age of what would be natural menopause. That's around the age of 51 in this country. Now, what's interesting is that if you look at the risk of bone loss and of having fractures in the future, it turns out it doesn't matter when you underwent menopause in terms of the risk of fracture later on. One would think intuitively that it does. But most hip fractures occur around the age of 70, and when you get to that age and you're looking at hip fractures, it really doesn't matter at what age the woman went through menopause. So I would recommend giving a low-dose birth control pill when it's appropriate, otherwise treating the symptoms and making sure we give adequate doses of calcium, vitamin D, and recommending weight-bearing exercise.
I hope that was helpful, Laverne. Thanks so much for your call. Neil, speaking of medication, you said that you recommend certain antidepressants, especially for hot flashes. Which one, how does that work?
Well, the antidepressants that affect serotonin specifically, yeah, what we call serotonin reuptake inhibitors like Prozac and Paxil, Zoloft, those kinds of medications, they have been shown to certainly be better than placebo. Again, the placebo response rate is about 30% when it comes to hot flashes, but that about 50 to 60% of people will actually find benefit with those kinds of medications, as well as medications that also affect serotonin and norepinephrine. Those would be things like Effexor and those kinds of medications.
How does that work?
Well, it's a great question. But one of the reasons is that we believe, and one of the reasons they were even studied in hot flashes, is because people who were studying what causes hot flashes noticed that there were changes in norepinephrine and serotonin when people had hot flashes. And so the concept was, okay, can we target these particular neurochemicals that we think are involved in mediating these hot flashes and help these women with a non-hormonal strategy. And interestingly enough, they certainly work. There's another medication called Neurontin, which people may know being used for chronic pain. It's also an anti-epileptic medication. That medication also seems to be effective in the treatment of hot flashes, but it affects a completely different neurotransmitter system called GABA. So we know that these neurochemicals that are involved in mood, sleep, appetite, anxiety also seem to be involved in mediating these hot flashes.
Oh, all the more reason to make sure your gynecologist is quite knowledgeable about menopause and the options for it. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Mary on the line.
Hi, it's a great show you're doing. I've had a whole bunch of friends who went through menopause who had big memory problems and who were convinced that they were losing their marbles. One of them even was thinking about suicide. And I said, no, this is about menopause and you're not crazy and you're not losing your marbles. But what I've found is that the focus is so much on things like hot flashes and dryness and whatnot that there's very little focus on the fact that many, many women get memory problems that are perfectly normal and natural, and they're a pain in the neck, but they're really not discussed very much. So none of my friends had heard from any doctor that what was happening to them was just normal. And I wish you'd comment on that.
Neil?
Well, Mary, thank you so much for calling in with that question. It is absolutely important for us to spend time in this show talking about the cognitive and sort of what we call brain effects of changes in hormones. And quite frankly, if you look at the data and the literature, it's a little bit controversial because there's some people who would say that estrogen actually worsens cognition for postmenopausal women. But again, those were from studies that were focusing on women who were sort of later in the menopause transition, sort of maybe 10 years past having their final period before starting hormone therapy. And I think the predominance of the evidence suggests that taking hormone therapy much later in life in one's 60s and 70s isn't going to be helpful for cognition. But there are definitely women that I've seen in my clinical practice, and I think research in both animals and humans support this, that early in the transition, if a woman is experiencing significant cognitive changes, that trying hormone therapy could be a reasonable option. But I think it's important to talk to your doctor because there may be other issues going on, such as changes in thyroid function can also affect one's cognition. If she's having sleep deprivation, that certainly can affect the ability to focus and be able to perform on a daily basis. So truthfully, you're absolutely right. Your friends are not going crazy. They're not losing their marbles. This is not early onset dementia. But really, it is for some women, they do experience more cognitive changes than others.
I've got a question that affects me personally, and I'll turn it to you, Ann. All of my long-term nurses, three-quarters of them, are either perimenopausal, in menopause, or just on the tail ends of menopause. And all of their memories are being affected. And I'm afraid one day I'm going to leave the house without my pants on. So tell me this memory loss is temporary.
I can't promise you anything, Dan.
Oh my
what I can
God.
Tell you is that memory loss, and I agree with Neil, comes with age. And it's very difficult to tie it in with the menopause itself. Dementia is a whole different story. And what I find is that as women age, they need to make lists. They need to double-check what they're doing. They just need to be more careful. But I can't really say that it's absolutely a menopausal issue so much as it's an age issue.
All right. Well, I appreciate your openness and honesty, and now I'm going to have to go home and increase my dose of antidepressants because of that. I want to read an email I received from a listener just this morning. She said she wanted to hear discussion about uterine cancer, which is preceded by hyperplasia during perimenopause. She said she didn't know anything about it until she was diagnosed with complex atypical hyperplasia, and she had a radical hysterectomy at age 52. So could you discuss that, Ann?
There's different types of hyperplasia. Simple hyperplasia really does not increase the risk of endometrial cancer much more than a couple of percent. But once we get into complex hyperplasia with atypia, the risk of developing endometrial cancer can be as high as 20%, possibly even more. So usually the recommendation is to do a hysterectomy. Because this is a woman who not only has abnormal tissue, but has a propensity to develop abnormal tissue. Usually, however, it's treated with a simple hysterectomy, not a radical hysterectomy, which involves taking larger amounts of tissue.
Yeah,
and we would remove the ovaries at the same time in a woman who is of appropriate age. Now, sometimes we see this kind of a tissue diagnosis in the very young women, and women who haven't even finished their childbearing. And in those women who wanted to preserve childbearing, we might treat them with high-dose progestins and monitor them very closely so that they could keep their uterus. But otherwise, yes, we recommend hysterectomy and removal of the ovaries.
We've got to take a short break now. When we come back, I want to talk about many of the other factors, including libido, which is a concern for many. We're talking today about menopause with Drs. Neil Epperson and Ann Steiner. Neil Epperson's a psychiatrist. She directs the Penn Center for Women's Behavioral Wellness. Ann Steiner is a clinical associate professor of OBGYN at Penn Health for Women. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Walk MS supports WHYY. Research shows that one out of two local residents know someone living with multiple sclerosis. That someone, your sister, coworker, or even that neighbor who insists on cheering for the Yankees, needs your help. Walk MS is changing the lives of the thousands of local someones affected by MS. More at 800-883-WALK or walkforms.org. That's walkforms.org for the Walk MS coming this spring in a community near you.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Have you been feeling anxious or depressed, had mood swings, or been diagnosed with bipolar disorder? The Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit at Penn Medicine is researching better treatment for bipolar disorder, anxiety, and depression. You may be eligible for a research study of the effects of medications or natural supplements to treat these symptoms. Initial evaluations determine eligibility for participation. To learn more, 215-662-3462, 215-662-3462.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about menopause with Drs. Ann Steiner and Neil Epperson. Neil, a dear friend of mine said recently that this is a time in her life where she hoped to have lots and lots of sex. The kids are gone. She's not worried about getting pregnant. And she doesn't have much libido. She said she's really disappointed in her body.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an issue that I hear about a lot because, you know, women, when they're going through the menopause, that's one of the fears that they have is that all of a sudden they're going to lose their libido. And I think part of that has to do with the fact that it's a time where they're no longer reproductive, meaning the capacity to bear children is gone. And for some women, that psychologically can have an impact on their sense of self as a woman. I certainly don't think it should, but for some women it does. And so they may come to counseling to sort of talk about what does this stage in their life mean. Also, many women have been involved with the same partner for many years at that time point. And so as human beings, we have a tendency to be turned on by novelty. And so she may be feeling like she needs to add something new in her relationship with her partner. This kind of comment reminds me of a study that was done by a colleague of mine in Australia. A woman named Lorraine Dennerstein, and she followed women through the menopause transition and looked at quality of life, libido, and sexual satisfaction being one aspect of quality of life. And she said in a meeting, and everybody cackled afterwards, but I think it was a good point she was trying to raise, she said the best predictor for a good libido in the postmenopausal woman is a new partner. And when I say this in front of a group of women, they all laugh, and I say, no, I'm not suggesting that you go out and get a new partner by any stretch of the imagination, because that's obviously easier said than done, and it may not be a good thing for you. But it does bring up this concept of adding something new in your relationship, adding something that would be fun for the two of you, maybe going away together. There are a lot of ways to instill sort of a life in your libido other than just using hormone therapy, because bottom line, hormone therapy for postmenopausal women has not been really reliably shown to increase sexual interest and libido. It does decrease vaginal dryness, which can be a problem for some women having sex. But as far as the actual interest and satisfaction, that's much more complicated than just hormones.
What does increase libido besides finding a new partner?
Well,
a new activity with an old partner?
It's a great question, and I think it varies depending upon the individual. There's no study out there that I can point to that says that this particular pill, I mean, unfortunately, women don't have a little Viagra. We don't have that as an option for us. And, you know, again, I think that libido is a much more complex issue for women. And so if they're interested in sort of enhancing their libido, there are sexual people who really specialize in sex counseling, and couples can get together and go to a sexual counselor who's somebody who specializes in thinking about these things, and work with someone like that if that's an important issue in their life.
Great answer. Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Francis on the line. Francis?
Just wanted to call and say, to reassure your listeners that it's not always a terrible experience. Now, I know many women who have experienced the side effects that you've cited, but for me, it was nothing. I started when I was 11 years old. It ended when I was in my mid-40s. I'm now a senior citizen. And actually, when it stopped, I wondered the first 3 months, is it over? It was nothing. And I just wanted your listeners to know that it's not always the experiences that have been cited. That's all.
You, I appreciate your call, Francis. And as soon as Neil heard your call, like she got visibly happy here. Neil?
Well, Frances, first of all, my mother's name is Frances, and she actually says the exact same thing.
Is that your mother?
My mother's name. This is not my mother.
Oh.
I didn't pay my mother to call. But Frances, thank you so much for bringing that up, because my mom says the exact same thing. She went through menopause without a single hot flash, and it was really a nothing experience for her as well. So I really appreciate you sharing that with the group.
I want to ask a question on behalf of my daughter. I've got a weird and wonderful daughter. Well, both of them are weird and wonderful, but Allie has spent a lifetime suffering with PMS, and she gets debilitating migraines. And I think she's one of the few women on the planet that says she's looking forward to menopause so she won't get her periods anymore. Your reaction?
Well, she should talk to somebody about her migraines, because if they're cyclic and associated with her menses, her doctor may be able to help her with that. But yes, many of these menstrual migraines, cyclic migraines, that usually come with the onset of menses or right before menses, do disappear with the menopause, and women are absolutely thrilled that this happens. But not all migraines disappear with menopause.
Yeah. So I guess that's good news and bad news. Hopefully she's listening to the show today. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Valerie on the line. Hi, Valerie.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Let me just turn you up a little bit. Okay, my question is I am like really kind of appalled that neither of these women have addressed bioidentical hormones. I had a total hysterectomy and oophorectomy, which means the ovaries were moved. About 6 years ago, I was on estradiol only, a patch, for the first year. And I was really not happy with my libido and other things, and I started taking bioidentical hormones and go to a compounding pharmacy. And all the studies that they're talking about, they're all studies were done with progestins, which is not real synthetic estradiol.
Valerie, you're breaking up here, but I think we've got the gist of your question. I'm so glad you brought it up. It's really an important issue. And what about bioidentical?
Well, I'd be happy to address that issue. I was hoping somebody would ask me. First of all, the estrogen patch which you received is a bioidentical hormone. It just happens to be FDA approved. The hormones which you get at your compounding pharmacy may also be bioidentical, but they aren't FDA approved, which means that their efficacy and their safety has not been studied. Now, I prescribe a lot of bioidentical hormones. Most of the time, almost always, they're FDA approved. So while the study, the drug that was studied in the Women's Health Initiative was Premarin, Prempro, and it comes from pregnant mare urine, it is not bioidentical. But guess what? it's natural. It's really the only natural hormone that we give because it's not chemically processed. Everything else pretty much has to be processed for us to deliver it in some way to a woman. Because, well, for instance, the plant sources, the phytoestrogens that can be converted to estradiol, which we put in a patch, has to be chemically processed in order for it to be identical to what a woman receives. Now, as far as the progestins and the progesterones are concerned, we do give natural progesterone. It comes as Prometrium or as a vaginal estrogen vaginal progesterone Procheve, and it is bioidentical, and it is FDA-approved, and I use that all the time. So what I think you're really talking about are compounded drugs that are not natural. They are bioidentical, and they are not FDA-approved for efficacy or safety.
Why are they not? Why are they not researched, Anne? And why don't we have a better handle on these? We keep talking about non-pharmaceuticals, natural drugs. Why are these things... Why don't we have controlled studies on these after all these years?
Well, that's a great question. Now, there are some studies which are ongoing, and I think Neil is involved in some of them. The KEEPS trial is looking at some of these estradiol, which is a bioidentical hormone, and so we are going to be looking at this, but we're looking at the FDA-approved drugs. So those studies actually, in terms of the bioidenticals, are ongoing. In terms of the compounded hormones, it's very expensive to do these studies. There'll never be a study done again as large as the Women's Health Initiative, which in just looking at what we've discussed today involved over 60,000 women. So it's difficult to do the study, and I don't know that there's really that much interest when we have bioidentical hormones that are FDA approved.
Hmm. Neil?
And I just wanted to say one thing to emphasize what Anne said about compounding pharmacies. One of the reasons why you can't do a research study using compounded pharmaceuticals is that they vary from different pharmacy. So what I might be getting from one pharmacy in Cherry Hill, New Jersey might be different than Yardley, Pennsylvania. And so when you do research studies, you need to know that every single one of your subjects is getting the exact same drug or hormone. And so it would be next to impossible to really use sort of compounding pharmacies for research studies.
Absolutely. They have, and thank you for saying that, Neil, they have actually looked at different batches of these compounded drugs within the same pharmacy and found that the amount of effective hormone in one batch was not the same as that in another batch. And when you get an FDA-controlled drug, presumably you are assured of that uniformity in delivery.
I want to go back to this issue of finding the right doctor. And how do we know, and I'll turn to you, Neil, how do we know that we have the right gynecologist? What do we ask? What do we look for?
Well, it's interesting because a lot of people come to me for the behavioral health aspects of their care, but they ask me that same question.
Yeah,
How do I find a gynecologist who's going to be able to work with me? And truthfully, the gynecologists who know the kinds of information that, for example, that Anne knows and is an expert in menopause, they're filled. And so trying to find a gynecologist that has open spots who really focuses on menopause can be quite daunting for a lot of women. One of the things that I really tell them, I say, look, if your gynecologist is not listening to you and you feel that they're just coming in and performing your annual exam and they don't want to take the time to answer your questions, you need to get a new gynecologist. Again, it can be easier said than done, but it is better to search for a gynecologist who really has this information, knows how to answer your questions, than to stay with somebody that you're unhappy with.
It's like any other doctor, I guess. If you have a doctor that's treating your hormonal changes rather than treating you, you need a different doctor. I guess it's the same as any other doctor.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and they are out there. And how difficult is it to find a gynecologist who is quite knowledgeable about menopause?
Dan, I don't know how to quantitate that. 80% of my practice are women who are approaching or in menopause. Certainly all these baby boomers, as I said, have come of age and are very interested in this. So while there's a lot of interest among patients, I think that we don't address this as well as we could in teaching our residents and our medical students, and that because of that, a physician and an obstetrician gynecologist have to kind of go out of their way to get this information. So I think being educated as a clinician, going to the meetings of the North American Menopause Society, keeping up with what they're published, certainly can help one to become somewhat of an expert in this field. As far as the patient finding that doctor, I don't know the answer.
That's a kind of a sad commentary. Neil, these days, women do have more choices than ever before. That can be good news, that can be bad news, huh?
Oh, absolutely. I think sometimes when we're presented with so many choices, it can be overwhelming. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of women turn to the internet. They want to read about hormone therapy or other non-hormonal strategies to treat depression or hot flashes, or if they're having cognitive changes that they don't know whether it's related to hormonal changes or just aging, as Anne has said. So they go first off to often the internet. And sometimes what they find on the internet, it can be pretty frightening. What they really need is to have a clinician that can answer their questions that they can go to. So whether it's a gynecologist, a primary, their primary care doctor, or they come to see me as a behavioral health specialist, this is where they really need to talk to someone who can answer their questions so that they don't pick up things on the internet that they can be afraid of.
And give us that website again that you spoke so highly
of. Sure. The website of the North American Menopause Society is menopause.org. And I actually can tell you about a couple of books which are very useful, I find, to my patients.
You have to go quickly because we're just about out of time.
One is Menopause Matters by Julia Edelman, and the other is Hot Flashes, Hormones, and Your Health by Joanne Manson, who's one of the lead investigators of the Women's Health Initiative.
And we will get all that information up on our webpage. I want to thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Dan. It's been a pleasure.
We've been talking about menopause with Drs. Neil Epperson and Anne Steiners. Listen, you can keep the conversation going on our WHYY's Facebook page. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to talk about the emotional impact of Alzheimer's on families. Well, you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com or our production team at voices@whyy.org. And to download today's show or listen to past shows, you can get us on whyy.org/voices or on iTunes. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our volunteer. Mark Cernero is our intern. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Me, I've been told to say I'm Danny Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends. The Drexel.